This is the Genuine Humans podcast, brought to you by Social Element. I'm Tamara Littleton.
And I'm Wendy Christie.
In our podcast, we'll discover the stories of the leaders behind the brands and the trailblazers who are making a real difference in our industry. We'll delve into how they got to where they are today.
And we'll hear about the genuine humans who supported and influenced them along the way.
Welcome back to Genuine Humans, and I'm here, as always, with my lovely co-host, Wendy. Wendy, how are you doing?
Hello, I'm very well, very glad to be here. How are you doing?
I'm good, and I'm particularly pleased that we have a fantastic guest on today. We have Nick Keane, and Nick has worked both agency and brand side, working with P&G, JWT, Diageo and Stolly, which we're going to hear all about. He's now also started his own venture in the no and low alcohol beverage space as one of the founders of Dioni Life. Welcome, Nick.
Great to see you both.
Well, shall we sort of jump in? So one of the questions that I like to ask is, well, how did you get to where you are now? So let's start with your early career, if you wouldn't mind, and just give a bit of a flavor of how you got into this space and some of the roles that you've had.
Great. Well, I was thinking about this, like dividing into a couple of chapters, really. And so let's start with the first chapter. And the themes that underlie these career choices, as I went back and was reflecting, is my deep sense of curiosity. I wouldn't just say a drive, but I'd talk about a compulsion to make things better. Big things, small things, people, and then that sense of personal improvement. And therefore, when I come to the career piece, my first job was at Procter & Gamble, known as the University of Marketing at the time. I moved up to Newcastle, had a fabulous time up there in UK brand management, in detergents or a core business. And that was a fantastic experience. But one of the things they had at the time, and they stopped the program shortly afterwards, was the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. And it made you reflect on what you really wanted. And one of the P&G rules, along with all the discipline of one pages and all the things they trained you to do, was the 80-20 rule. And I found I was spending 20% on what I really, really enjoyed, and I wanted to flip and make it 80%. And what I really enjoyed was how the brands were positioned and developed and really connected with humans and that whole kind of piece. So I moved down to London to J. Walter Thompson, the ad agency, and that was known as the University of Advertising at the time. So there's a bit of a thematic here. And got to work, as you do in agencies, on tons of different clients and tons of different categories. And again, fueling my interest and curiosity on how things worked, different types of communication. And I was there for a number of years and got increasingly involved in the drinks business before Diageo was actually Diageo. And I was working on brands like Tanqueray Gin and Malibu. I mean, I had a great was a chunk of my time traveling around the US where Tanqueray was principally sold, and in the Caribbean, making award-winning can Malibu ads with clients like Ed Pilkington, who I'm still in touch with. And that was all wonderful and brilliant until a pirate came along called Captain Morgan. And Diageo bought Captain Morgan in an acquisition and in short had to sell Malibu. And they invite, and I was on the list of people involved in the business. And they said, well, you've done a bit of marketing, come over and help us out. So I moved to Amsterdam for 6 months, and nearly 20 years later, eventually left my last role being Captain Morgan. But in between all of that, I've worked on gins, numerous Scotch whiskies like Talisker Lagavulin Singleton, led Guinness across Africa, worked in, I could go on, but a whole bunch of international brands. And I was, again, just thinking coming into this, I think I've worked in over 40 countries now. And a bit back to adventure, curiosity, understanding people in different parts of the world, and worked to bring about half the states in the US as well. So an international brand building career that I love, and a journey that I'm still on. I think that's a very brief tour of, let's call it, 30 years, frankly, in those three companies. Chapter two changed when COVID hit. And I'm at home changing all our programs onto different sort of content, filming things on cameras, doing all kinds of things. The brand's one of the best performing in Diageo, but everything I enjoyed, getting out there, being with the team, seeing the world, all that was taken away from me. And it was that point, if I don't, you know, what do I really want? If I'm not going to change now, will I ever change? And my friends always said to me, you're always learning and developing. When are you actually going to get on and apply that in a different context rather than talk about, you know, that endless journey of improvement and development in these larger organizations? And at that time, a guy I knew, a chap called Damian McKinney, who was CEO of Stoli at the time, I'd first met him right back at the creation of Diageo when he was doing some integration work. And he said, do you want to join? And Stoli, and he kind of thought, well, I'm not sure. I just asked him three questions, actually. How big's the mountain? How steep are the sides? And who am I climbing it with? Because I've come to the conclusion that he just wanted to kind of, it needed to be ambitious. I was looking for difficulty, not ease. And it is about the journey and who you travel with. And that was a real, again, acceleration of that learning and development curve, and just so different from corporate. When I was sitting there, I walked into a cash flow crisis. You're scrabbling around with smaller budgets. I think they've been through 15 CEOs in 20 years. This was never going to be easy. And I was aware of what I was, the reputation of the business, but the potential of brands were enormous. And to make matters worse, within 6 months, Russia invaded Ukraine. And I was working in a Russian-owned business, which was vodka-led with a Russian vodka. And people were pouring our product down the drain on CNN, and bars were kicking us out, and senators were saying ban the product. And yeah, you can imagine the scenario. And that was a proper crisis. And actually, we ended up hitting the best sales the business had ever had in 20 years, because we turned it around and we turned it into a story of truth of the founders' resistance to the Putin regime, the 20 years he hadn't been home for. But again, it may be a longer conversation for a different time, but a proper crisis where you're literally sitting there going, if we aren't clear on what we believe in, the business will go under. If we are clear on what we believe in, our owner could be killed, or maybe one of his kids could. And so that's what we were kind of playing out. But we went with our values, and we went with what we believed in. And for a company with limited cash and scale, our story got enormous coverage and PR, and we were doing Ukraine limited edition bottles and all that kind of stuff, and growing the full portfolio by just doing the right thing. So that was a terrific learning experience, rather than budgets year to year. You're in week to week, month to month. And eventually the cash flow issues returned. I won't break all that down as to the why, but some of those overdues are starting to increase again. And I felt that actually the impact I could make and the change I wanted to make was getting to a point where it was time to do something else. But I'm incredibly grateful for that opportunity, because I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now if it wasn't for that. And after that, things got a little bit, not a little bit different for me. So I had a job the day I had a job offered my second year of university. So I walked out of university straight into a job. I've never not had a job. It was Christmas 23, and the opportunity came up to help build this non-alcoholic business that we'll get in and talk about. And I said, do I do that or do something else? Pretty soon, this took my life over. So actually, I had a job. I didn't realize initially what it was, but full-time setting up a business, looking for funding, looking for acquisitions, doing the whole piece. The only difference was it was a job I wasn't being paid to do. But it was a job that I'd never had to work so hard for, because you can't be half in if you're going to set yourself up as a new business. You have to believe, and everything you come across just has to be set up, because it's just not in place. Which led us to, maybe we'll come back to this, in September, 31st of August last year, we closed the financing round on the business. We've got a fully funded business from an American partner. We made our first acquisition, Mash Gang Beer, partly owned by someone who used to work at the Social Element and worked for me, Mike Baggs.
Absolutely, Mike Baggs, the amazing Mike Baggs. Yeah, that's such a great acquisition.
Exactly. And we've been up and running since we opened business on the 1st of September. So happy to talk more about Dioni Life and that whole piece. But that whole journey from working for someone, from working for yourself, the challenge of fundraising, particularly in the current environment, were all new learnings. And yeah, great experience.
Thank you. We'll definitely come back to that.
Before we do, do you mind if we go even further back in your journey and look at, you know, what you were like as a child and see if we can pick out any of those themes? I mean, you talked a lot about curiosity and being adventurous and that sort of always learning and developing. Did that start as a child?
Yes. I can point to specific moments. I think the child context was I was unhappy with my circumstances rather than necessarily deeply unhappy with kind of who I was. And a bit of context then on the why. I think it is good to, it's a great question, Wendy, go back and reflect. I've been lucky to have various coaches over the while time, and I think it's really good to try and unpick some of this stuff. And it tends to fall into camps of my childhood was wonderful and I loved it, or it was a complete disaster kind of piece. I guess my piece was the context I found myself in. I think it's definitely helped shape me. And there are a couple of things probably to highlight on that. Firstly, I moved around a lot. So back to this sense of adventure and curiosity. By the time I was 18, I'd had 20 different parental homes.
Wow.
And so I was always on the move, meeting different people, moving around. And there were various reasons for that, including at one point my parents moving from the UK to Asia and me staying in the UK, and that was formative. The other piece was my father was a terrible manager of money. So he was quite a successful lawyer, actually, but he just had to cash flow. He couldn't manage his money well, so he would spend the money when he got work, when he did the work, and he got paid for the work. So it's slightly irrelevant what you earn. It's all down to what you've got left over. House size were theirs for going up and down. We were the state agent's dream. Later in life, he actually diagnosed with bipolar, which I think was one of the things driving that. And he actually died very young. He died at a similar age I am now, which is always a bit sobering. But he lived a very fast, full, adventurous life. Eventually, and I think the role of mum, I've probably haven't fully valued and appreciated as to how much she had to put up with, including, you know, dealing with a whole bunch of stuff, and, you know, principally, you know, us as well. And so that led to, yeah, let's call it a lot of movement or whatever. For me personally, by 11, I was sent off to school, and I actually never really went back home. That was where I felt entrapped, imprisoned, and really unhappy in terms of my context. And the school was, best way to describe it really, but run by a bunch of monks, and I was regularly beaten.
Oh my God.
I was pretty high up on the charts of most beaten child in year.
That's awful. I'm really sorry to hear that. That's just...
No, thank you, Wendy. I don't think all of that stuff is actually fully come out in terms of... I know there's material out there, but not everyone's held to account. Frankly, I think of it as child abuse. But it does sort of shape you for that type of experience. And so a focus on that, their agenda was very simple. It was about Christianity first and gentlemen, whatever that means. And then last actually was academics. And mostly people were untrained teachers as well. So it was a slightly strange place as I look back on it.
Did you have a sense that not all kids were going through this? Did it feel like it was your normal, but not everyone else's? Or?
Well, I knew it was slightly unusual to be brought up by a bunch of monks who arguably weren't qualified for the job in the first place. So I knew it was unusual, but, you know, some people seem to thrive on it. But for me, it felt like imprisonment. So for me, from all the moving around, I was locked down, rule bound, that whole piece, you know, very, you know, forced to fit in, all that piece. And look, many people have much worse circumstances, and so it's nothing to... But I think the point is it shapes you, to your point, Wendy. And I can literally remember the point at age 15 where I decided just to take the initiative and tell the school that things are going to have to stop, that there would be problems if they carried on any physical abuse. They said, well, do you think you should leave? And we went a bit back and forth and all of that stuff. And we reached an accommodation where essentially I left school early, actually. But as soon as school was finished, And bear in mind, my parents were on the other side of the world. I used to whiz up to London on a Saturday morning, hang out around Soho, Camden, and all those kind of places, and, you know, sleep on a friend's floor and stuff like that, and hit the clubs. And the clubs and the music scene in the 80s, the 100 Club, the Mud Club, you know, down to heaven maybe later on, and all that stuff was remarkably liberating and fun and adventurous, and that brought amazing energy. And I was sort of, that was my outlet, and my connection with the world and my sense of adventure. Just turned 17, I took all my A-levels. I was able enough to kind of get through those to a reasonable level. Got a place in university, and then accelerated on from there. So, yeah, I went off to, got a job, took some money, went to the US, ended up living with a presidential candidate, going around the US, helping them get the voters out, run their campaign. I was, again, coming into doing all kinds of stuff. From, I remember having to ask Mike Tyson to do a job, to Linda Carter, Wonder Woman. I had to have dinner with her once, and ask for her help on another project. So, I mean, things really moved very, very quickly. And by the time I went to university, I'd had a ton of life experience and adventure. But I think the driver of that was just seizing control, wanting to get out and just live a full life. I just think life was short. Seize the day, have some fun, etc.
Incredible journey. And as on that journey, whether, you know, when you were a child or, you know, thinking about your career as well, have there been people who you've looked up to or who've really supported you and championed you in your career? Anyone that you can name check?
It's quite a long list. When the places I've worked, I've been really lucky with the talented people I've got to work for and be inspired by. I remember at JW2, a very young CEO at the time, you know, a few years older than me, but, you know, he was in his 20s, so Stephen Carter. And people like Martin, who went on to lead the AAR, were there at the time. And again, a wonderful, smart, good people leading different pieces of businesses, and the chance to kind of move around a number of them. A lot of the list would come from Diageo, from Rob Malcolm, the first CMO I worked for. I was thinking of the professor of marketing, and then followed by Andy Fennell, who I'm still in touch with. He's just an extraordinary, brilliant person. And, you know, Gender's like 10 out of 10 creative, and marketing as the growth leading function, and how the role of marketing is into Sill, who took that GM mindset. Kathy Parker, actually, when Kathy left Diageo, that was, again, one of the pokes that made me think about what I was doing. The best boss I ever had, just incredibly smart technically, someone who should get on something like this, but probably, you know, might not want to do it, because she always, it was a play to strength game. She was demanding, but she always wanted you to be the best version of yourself, and that be the route to success. And she put great teams together. Yeah, Ed, I've touched on, still, I think, one of the best marketers in Diageo. I mean, wherever he is, the work always gets better. And then, you know, I could go up more recently, you know, James Thompson, Andy Gibson, and, you know, Mark Sands with his orchestration piece, and Andrew Gagan I've mentioned as well, who's now CMO at William Grant. He was head of planning. Just, I mean, they were all, I would feel gifted if any one of them had been a mentor or a supporter, and I feel really lucky that I've had so much opportunity to learn from good people who I'm, you know, a number of that list I'm still very much in touch with.
And let's bring you back up. And firstly, just to say thank you for sharing your story. A lot of sort of resilience, and I can see how it shaped you. Bringing you back to the last 12 months, 18 months, the Diony life, let's go into that more, because you've got such an ambitious vision for reshaping the no and low alcohol drink sector. So what inspired you to take that leap? And also, can you perhaps share a bit more about the USP of Diony Life?
Yeah, I think looking around I spent a lot of my time, if you go back, in alcohol. And I love having fun, going out for drinks, the role that bars and restaurants play in people's lives, and my career therefore has taken me to say lots of, not just countries, but when we go to those countries, you know, wonderful places and meet wonderful people. I I just think the role alcohol's always had in the heart of socialization has always drawn me. And it comes back to the from to of me wanting to go full fun and full experience when I chose to really seize that moment right back when I was 15. So that was the context. But I was well aware of all the trends, particularly when I was running Captain Morgan. And I was looking at what are the risks and what are the opportunities. And there were so many headwinds, including the shift of younger people to experience and not drinking, or certainly a large number of them just drinking a lot less and being slightly indifferent to that. So if we were catching up, my default would be, let's go for a beer, or let's go for a drink, or let's go to a bar. The offer would really be, let's catch up and socialize. But that was clearly kind of breaking down. And I've always prided myself in looking for emerging trends and that whole piece. And so I could see all the problems. And my thought was, it's not actually, I couldn't see why they would change. And beyond that, you know, the growth of digital technology, I mean, very simple things like the fact that most of us have some sort of Fitbit, Apple Watch on, and the fact that we've found out that brandy or whiskey at the end of the night, or, you know, that rather than settles you down and relaxes you, costs you 3 points on your sleep score, and that kind of constant nudging and realizing that some things you thought were true actually aren't kind of true. And so the digital piece, the health and wellness piece across all generations, these feel like fundamental things that are here to stay. And all of those, ethanol doesn't help the situation. The one benefit of drinking, we talk about the science and the downsides and all that, is actually there is benefit in socializing. And that is really important to us as people and our mental and physical health. But the ethanol bit itself isn't a positive. It's just the getting together piece. So I was looking at that, looking at all the trends and the growth of non-alc. We're, to be clear, when I say pure play, we're not no and low. We're only no. We want nothing to do with the ethanol piece. But our hypothesis was, at the moment, the choice you often get made is, I'm going to call it the worthy choice. We all know that, you know, there are worthy choices on offer, and a lot of the non-alc brands were leading on the fact that they won non-alc. And our view was, why do you need to compromise? You know, we need to get the taste right, at least as good as the alcohol equivalents. When we're developing products, we always taste against full strength alcohol. We don't taste against other non-alcs. Yes, of course, there are implicit health benefits. But back to socialization and brand experience, it is about connecting and having fun at the end of the day. And you don't want to be the person just being marked out as the, you know, I'm having the healthy option. So what we wanted to do was create a scale business, and we're a startup now, that was multi-brand, multi-category, that offered an alternative to the large alcohol companies, to customers, not just consumers. Because it is hard to build a single brand. So a lot of these individual non-alc brands, their only choice is to sell to an alcohol business, which to some extent defeats the object of what they were trying to promote. And we just advocate choice. So we're non-judgmental, but we just saw a gap in the market for a business that wasn't in some way tied or linked to the legislation and rules around alcohol, or had to justify why their non-alcoholic version was the same brand as their alcoholic version or whatever. And we wanted something kind of clean and simple that just offered great tasting drinks that just happen not to have ethanol, that are wonderful brands. And that's what we got the funding to develop over the next 15 years.
Fantastic. And for anyone wanting to make the move, because you've obviously gone brand side, you've thrown yourself into this, and any sort of key learnings so far over the last year?
I think so. The first one is money. So,
you need it.
you need it. The journey to making money isn't straightforward. So and it essentially is a cash flow game, not just a money game. You need to be in business as long as you can be, to create to give yourself the timeline to grow and to go to the next level. And there's a challenge there between the speed of which you grow and, if you like, the cost of that kind of growth. But initially, it's very hard to build a business that is growing sufficiently and making any money. In fact, most of these, not just in this sector, but most startups for a while will be losing money. So therefore, how do you source your funding? To what extent do you bootstrap stuff? To what extent do you go elsewhere? Think to the future. So if you're raising on friends and family and building up lots of shareholders, essentially, to get what you need to do to build your amazing vision to life, you can end up with very complicated structures, and you spend a lot of your time managing all your stakeholders, all of whom have different agendas as to when they want their money in or out, or what the return is, and you get a lot of people well-intentioned, but takes you away from growing that business you came in to grow. And the other thing, and like just dwelling on the money piece, is that the world's changing in the last couple of years. The low interest rates are just unprecedented in the last 200 years. And arguably, we've been in a low inflationary period for longer than since 2008. But certainly, there was a 10-plus year period where money was essentially free. And people just got used to it. And it was easier to raise money when it was free. Now, money should have a cost, and it does. And now money has got a cost. The fundraising environment in the last couple of years has got a lot tougher. And a lot of businesses are running into trouble because when you've got to start paying a price for your money and it's harder to borrow, that's when things can go wrong. Or businesses that aren't fundamentally sound, for frankly, go under. So what? What's all this got to do with things? It just means that if I knew now how hard it was to raise money, I might not have jumped in. There's something about if you knew everything, you might not jump in and do some of these things. Because I, at the end of the journey raising the money from the US investor, they said, well, we only do one or two deals a year. And you kind of go, blimey, one or two deals a year. There's like 30 of you. Like, how do you just do one or two deals a year? And that's because their bar is so high. What was unusual about us is we didn't have a growing business, an ongoing business. It's really hard to raise money for just an idea. We've all got an idea, and you know, we've all got a book, an idea, something we'd really like to do. I do think it's a lot easier if you've proven your concept and got some real evidence that it can work when you look for scalability. But your investor partner and your investor structure is really, really, really key. And then obviously treat the money as your own as you do. But what I hadn't fully appreciated, and it's obvious to me now, is if you borrow a lot of money, as we do, they expect you to put your own money in. So having joked that I had a busy job that I wasn't getting paid for, you could argue now I'm actually paying to work. And that's because they really want to make sure that if they're going to lose a lot of money, you have real blood, you know, there'll be blood
skin
on the
in the game. Yeah, absolutely.
Your kids' futures will be affected in that whole piece. And at first of all, is that right? And you kind of go, it does drive a certain focus and alignment. So, I mean, yeah, and obviously there are upsides. We hope to be tremendously successful. And if it goes well, you share in those rewards. But that whole piece was really interesting. The whole market analysis, finding the right acquisitions, the challenge of making an acquisition. We couldn't set the business up without an acquisition, you know, landing that purchase. Again, lots of learnings there. But in the end, come back to the consumer, find a great brand, make sure it's really distinctive. I mean, the fundamental truths kind of stand, and then you're just trying to make the numbers kind of add up. So yeah, it's so exciting, but every day we come up with nothing exists. You will know this from your own business, but when you start a business, anything, I don't know, payroll, anything you come up across, nothing's in place. So
yeah,
I've got to work out how to do that. Thank God for Google and ChatGPT in part as well.
Yes, well, exactly. Yeah, we always have a sort of a bit of a saying that anything can change in a day as well. Honestly, it's just the highs and the lows. And have you sort of sensed that you've changed as a person just over the last 12 years as a result of this new venture?
I think I am am who I am, really. So I don't think I've changed as a person. But as I look back since leaving Diageo, that time at Stolly and now this setting up a business has really, really accelerated my learning and development curve. And that is really, really important. I feel I can play bigger, make a bigger difference. Again, big and small ways, both broadly to the shape of how people, you know, socialize in the world, but in a micro level, helping people develop, creating employment. You know, it's really, really rewarding when I come back to that. Now, it's hard, but it's really, really rewarding. So I don't think I've changed as a person. I'm just getting on with doing what I love doing and feeling empowered to do it. And I definitely, look, I hope this is massive for the next 10, 15 years. And I don't see why it wouldn't be. But I definitely see as I look forward, you know, now this is the journey that I'm on, and yeah, I want to keep building on what I'm learning and doing. But it's so exciting. You have to get involved from, say, nose to tail. I mean, at one level tomorrow, and in it's a distributor meeting in one state, and then next week it's a board meeting with a bunch of, you know, bankers and McKinseyites in New York. I mean, you go from big to small in a way that you just wouldn't in a larger organization, because the lines are more more thinly cut in terms of,
yeah.
So I don't know if that answers it.
No, it really does, and we're wishing you so much success on this journey. Really excited to see what the next acquisitions are as well. So we'll move on now to the last part of the podcast. So this is very quick fire questions, and I'll let Wendy jump in with the first one.
Okay, so what's your idea of a perfect weekend?
Right now, my idea, what's really important to me is spend time with my wife, Ruth, and the kids. So I think there is an inherent downside, particularly not just around startups, but I've always worked all hours. I love what I do. I choose to do. If I didn't love what I do, I'd go off and find something else that I love that I do. And that's so important to me. But there is a little bit at times of guilt and selfishness of putting that so high on the agenda. And so rather than all the things I love to do and enjoy beyond, you know, personally, when it comes to the weekend, including I'm often working at the weekends, particularly at the moment, spending time with my two boys, 14 and 10, and my wife are really important. And if I can do that with things that I also enjoy doing, then that's even better. So if I can get the boys around and down to some live sport, if I can have some wonderful food, that's fantastic. I don't really mind where I am. I talk a lot about curiosity and going off and venturing and all that. One thing I think has changed, and it's partly circumstantial driven, is you can have an adventure anywhere. You can have an adventure in a boat. You can have an adventure just talking to someone different. That now I've got Mash Gang non-alcoholic beer, I'm often going up to people, giving one, swapping out what they're drinking for one, and then surprising them it hasn't got alcohol in and all that sort of stuff. So even in a world where, you know, time's constrained and you've got all these things you need to kind of get through, you can just walk into a different shop or take a different route, or there are so many ways one can find people, things, and just get different perspective on stuff. And so that's what I would love doing. The only thing I would add to that, and I don't do this, but I should do this, is in my ideal weekend, it would include a newspaper. One of the things, although I recognize how old-fashioned that sounds, I do get bothered by all the social media that I spend time looking at, as we all do, constantly feeding me what I like. And I'm always trying to, for example, on the BBC website, not register or not follow, because essentially, back, you know, I think to bring the world together, you need different perspectives. Given I keep talking about my interest and curiosity, I'm looking for external view, things I haven't thought about, things I haven't seen, not more and more of what I like and just that constant kind of narrowing. And I think a piece of paper in the form of the newspaper does that wonderfully now. I can't remember when I last sat down and read a newspaper on a Sunday, but I love the idea of it.
Yes, I know exactly what you mean. How would your friends describe you?
Yeah, words like creative, curious, supportive. People, when they get to know, surprise that I'm very introverted. And again, that might come back partly, there's some nature and nurture in that LP. So I've always been one for small groups rather than big groups. I'm happy to talk at a large event or do any of that stuff. But in terms of where my energy comes from, and that makes me at times actually initially quite hard to know. And so people kind of recognize that whole piece. But yes, you know, loyal, you know, people, you know, as I say, I have a small group of friends, and as people get to know me, I think, you know, that's, those deep relationships are really important to me, and I think that gets recognized when they describe who I am. And the fact that I'm, back to resilience, if it's the right thing to do, I'll swing out on it. I was surprised, and I find this in meetings when I can be the outlier in a meeting and aware that I'm an outlier, and people go, well, could you not see what was going on? It's like, I could see what was going on, but I felt a different perspective was needed. I thought that was wrong. It was the right thing to do. And I needed to put that on the table. And so again, was people see the behavior and then they understand the drive and some of the background to improve things, make a difference. They understand the contribution that I can make and the fact that if I see trouble, I go towards it. And it took me quite a long time in life to realize that people take a more sensible choice to go round it or avoid trouble. You know, why pick up a hot ball? I go, let's pick up the hot ball. That's where the action, energy, fun problem is.
Which goes all the way back to what you were saying before about, you know, standing up for yourself back in your school days. So, yeah, I can see that that's a really strong streak in you, Nick. Random question. I don't know if we've asked this one before. Do you have a favourite dinosaur?
I do. So favourite dinosaur, I'm going for a T-Rex. Now, that's a bit of a cliche, I expect, in terms of apex predator in all the movies, all that stuff. But I've gone for the T-Rex because it's the dinosaur most closely related to chickens. And I love the idea that living amongst us right now are all these mini dinosaurs. And if you look at a chicken through the lens, through a dinosaur lens, I think they are remarkable, extraordinary, and frankly, very tasty creatures. But so that's my dinosaur of choice.
If you could time travel to any point in the past or the future with no consequence, where and when would you travel to?
I'm going to London. I think I've worked in over 40 countries. I'm very interested in the world, but I am a Londoner. I'm proud to be a Londoner. And I think London 2030, 2300. So let them go. A couple hundred years into the future, I think, would be interesting because I think there is much of the world you can visit and discover now, much you can understand about the past. But why do I want to go to London in a couple hundred years' time? Because I don't know what it's going to be like. And I couldn't wait to see what it's like. So, yeah, that's what I would do.
How would you fare in a zombie apocalypse?
Badly. I actually listened to some of your podcast. I'm a keen podcast follower of yours. So it's an honor to kind of be on here.
Thank you.
I'm quite surprised how many of people on the podcast think they're going to survive. I think the answer is in the question. It's an apocalypse. I mean, everybody dies. So why on earth do I think at the end of the world that somehow I'm going to be fine, you know, staying at home, you know, with a good bottle of whiskey and doing whatever? Yeah, you know, yes. So there might be an immediate short term, you know, I think it's a question of time, but I don't think I've got an enormous amount of chance, particularly, as I say, living in a place like London, where you kind of think would be one of these things that this would spread really, really quickly. So I think the answer's in the question. As much as I could talk about some very short-term survival techniques, I think, all over.
Sudden death. Okay, well, I'm going to finish with my last question, which is, what would be the tagline on a poster for a movie about your life?
I'm not going to have a movie. I think it needs to be serialized. I think I'd want to get onto Netflix.
Brilliant.
And I think I'm going to call it Never Ending Adventure. I think if I could make it a game show somehow, that would be fun. But I really like something that's, yeah, really leans into that sense of big adventures, small adventures, and meeting people on the way. And I think, as I say, in small ways and big ways, that's how things need to work. We all need to be able to rub along together. And there's so much joy and stimulus in terms of visual and sound. And if you're trying new things the whole time. So The Never Ending Adventure would be my answer.
Netflix, if you're listening, we have your new commission for you. Nick, thank you so much for coming on. This has been an absolute joy and just so wonderful to hear your story and hear how everything is going. Have we missed anything? Is there anything that we should have asked you? Or I'll hand over the platform. Any closing thoughts from you?
So a few closing thoughts as I come into this. I think one thing I didn't touch on is, I mean, I call it Project Interesting. If you want to do interesting stuff, do interesting things. You've got to be with interesting people. How do you get there? With interesting situations. So I'm a strong advocate of meeting interesting people. I literally used to have a project, one of my ages, I want to meet someone interesting every month to build out that muscle. If that isn't your thing, and we all are different at different strands, then make sure in your team you find someone who brings that diversity of opinion and interest and stimulus. Because I think the best teams are diverse in a multifaceted kind of piece. Clearly, you know, as I say, I advocate that curiosity and creativity, a whole piece, but we all are who we are. So I've seen teams kind of go, actually, let's make sure I've got someone who's like that, who can play that role in my organization. I don't try and hire me. I try and hire people who are different from me, which makes managing a challenge, but the outcome's so much richer and better. The other thing, and I haven't talked about it, probably deliberately, actually, I just think I'm in the flow, is neurodiversity. A really important piece around who I am is I'm dyslexic. And I wasn't diagnosed at Skills, though. That was all a bit of a disaster. I was at my very end of university, my very final year of university, but it wasn't of much use academically. And I turned up to my job and I thought, this is quite cool. Lots of interesting people are dyslexic. And my boss, I felt my boss used it against me. So I never talked about it for another 20 years. And I haven't talked about it today till the end of this. My son was also diagnosed as dyslexic. I've never wanted to be labeled or put in a box. And I've never wanted excuses. And so it's never really served my purpose to emphasize it. I've always, but as I look back on it, that's something I'm trying to lean in and correct. Why? Well, because I think you need to be a role model to other people. Two, if I look back at some of those best bosses I've had, they've really understood what I can bring to the table and they've understood what I struggle with. And we've worked together as a team to kind of compensate and help each other and get to amazing outcomes. And I do think making sure that you have in your team people who think differently, not just are of different backgrounds, et cetera, is really, really, really just so important to be successful. So I do want to put that on the table because it is part of who I am, even though I choose not to go around with a badge. It is me and I need to own that.
Nick Keane, thank you so much.
You've been listening to Genuine Humans, brought to you by Social Element. If you loved what you heard, remember to rate, review, and subscribe.